or that parthenogenesis is the essential principle of all things, beings, thoughts, states, phenomenal. I'd be queried, if I should say, of the consummation of any human romance, that it is parthenogenetic, but humanity, regarded as a whole, is sustained by self-fertilization. Except for occasional, vague stories of external enrichments, there are no records of invigorations imparted to the humankind from gorillas, hyenas, or swine. Elephants fertilize elephants. I conceive of no bizarre, little love story, with a fruitful outcome, of the attractions of a rhinoceros to a hummingbird. Though I have a venerable, little story account sent to me by Mr. Ernest Dorfler, Bronx, NY of an 18th century scientist, whose theory it was that human females can be pollinated, and who experimented, by exposing a buxom female to the incidence of the east wind, and of course was successful in establishing his theory, I have no other datum of human and vegetable unions, so this reported occurrence must be considered one of the marvels from which this book of not uncommon events holds. Aloof. The parthenogenetic triumphs of the human intellect are circular stupidities. The mathematicians, in their intuitions of the state of a whole, have represented what to the devout is divinity, with the circle, which, to them the perfect figure, symbolizes getting nowhere. Much of the argument in this book will depend upon our acceptance that nothing in our existence is real. The whole may be realness. Out of its phenomena, it may be non-phenomenally producing offspring realnesses. That is not our present subject. But up comes the question, if nothing phenomenal is real, is everything phenomenal really unreal? But, if I accept that nothing is real, in phenomenal existence, I cannot accept that anything, therein, is really unreal. So my acceptance, in accordance with our general philosophy of the hyphen, is that all things perceptible to us are real unreal, varying from the direction of one extreme to the other, according to whatever may be the degree of their appearance of individuality. If anybody has the notion that he is a real being, and by realness I mean individuality, or call it entity, or unrelatedness, let him try to tell why he thinks he exists, in a real sense. Recall the most celebrated of the parthenogenetic attempts to make this demonstration. I think, therefore I am. We have to accept that in order to think, the thinker must be of existence prior to the thought. Why do I think? Because I am. Why am I? Because I think. The noblest triumphs of the human intellect are about as sublime as would be the description of a house in terms of its roof, whereas the description would be equally sublime, if in terms of the cellar, or the bathroom. That is Newtonism, or a description of things in terms of one of their aspects, or gravitation. It is Darwinism, a description of all life in terms of selection, one of its aspects. Gravitation is only another name for attraction. Sir Isaac Newton's contribution to the glories of human knowledge is that an apple falls because it drops. All living things are selected by environment, said Darwin. Then, according to him, when he shifted aspects, all things constituting living environment are selected. Darwinism, that selection selects. The materialists explain all things, except what they deny, or disregard, in terms of the material. The immaterialists, such as the absolute and the subjective idealists, explain all things in terms of the immaterial. My expression is in terms of the continuity of the material and the immaterial, or that one of these extremes is only an accentuation on one side, and the other only an accentuation on the other side, of the hyphenated state of the material-immaterial. I am a being who thinks, therefore I am a being who thinks. In this circular stupidity there is a simple unity that commends it to conventional lovers of the good, the true, and the beautiful. I do not think. I have never had a thought. Therefore something or another. I do not think, but thoughts occur in what is said to be my mind, though, instead of being in it, they are it, just as inhabitants do not occur in a city, but are the city. There is a governing tendency among these thoughts, just as there is among people in any community, or as there is in the movements of the planets, or in the arrangements of cells constituting a plant, or an animal. So far as goes any awareness of mine, I have no soul, no self, no entity, though at times of something like a harmonization of my elements, I approximate to a state of unified being. When I see as for convenience I shall say, even though there is no I that is other than a very imperfectly coordinated aggregation of experience states, sometimes ferociously antagonizing one another, but mostly maintaining a kind of civilization. But when I see that my thoughts are ruled by tendencies, such as to harmonize, organize, or coordinate, that they tend to integrate, segregate, nucleate, equilibrate, I am conscious of mere mechanical processes that mean no more in the arrangements of my ideas than they mean in the arrangements of my bones. I'd no more think of offering my ideas as immortal truth than I'd think of publishing X-ray photographs of my bones, as eternal. But the organizing tendency implicit in all things along with the disorganizing tendency implicit in all things has admirably expressed itself in the design that is my skeleton. I think so. I have no reason to think that my skeleton is in any way inferior to anybody else's skeleton. I feel that if I could arrange my ideas with the art that has arranged my bones, I'd have, for writing a book, the justification that all writers feel the need of, trying to excuse themselves for writing books. But I do not think that mechanism is all that there is in our existence. Only the old-fashioned absolutist conceives, or says he conceives, of our existence as absolutely mechanical. There is an individuality in things that is not of mechanical relations, because individuality is unrelatedness. I conceive of our existence as positive-negative, or as mechanical-immechanical. But my methods are the largely mechanical methods of everybody, and of everything, that harmonizes, or organizes. One of these methods is classification. I am impelled to arrange my materials under headings quite as a wind arranges fallen leaves, of various sizes, into groups as a magnet makes selections from a pile of various things. So, again, when I see that my thoughts are coerced by conventional processes, I can think of my thoughts as nothing but the products of coercions. I'd not do these slaves the honor of believing them. They impose upon me only to the degree of temporary acceptance of some of them. Merely thoughtfully, or only intellectually, I have made a collection of notes, under the classification of explosions. Some of the occurrences look as if explosive attacks, of an occult order, have been made upon human beings, or as if psychic bombs have been thrown invisibly at people, or at their property. In the New York Tribune, January 7, 1900, there is an account of poltergeist disturbances in a house, in Hyde Park, Chicago. According to the now well-known ways of chairs and tables, at times, these things hopped about, or moved with more dignity. It was as if into this house stole an invisible but futile assassin. See back to accounts of visible but futile bullets. Time after time there was a sound like the discharge of a revolver. It was noted that this firing always occurred at about the height of a man's shoulder. In a booklet, A Disturbed House and Its Relief, Ada M. Sharp tells of a seeming psychic bombardment of her home in Tackley, Oxon, England. Beginning upon April 24, 1905, and continuing 3 years, at times, detonations, as if of exploding bombs, were heard in this house. Upon the 1st of May, 1911, Lloyd's Weekly News, July 30, Wandsworth Borough News, July 21, unaccountable fires broke out in the house of Mr. J. A. Harvey, 356 York Road, Wandsworth, London. Preceding one of these fires, there were three explosions of unknown origin. In January, 1892, Peterborough Advertiser, January 10, 1892, a house in Peterborough, England, occupied by a family named Rhymes, was repeatedly shaken, as if bombed, and as if bombed futilely. Nobody was injured, and there was no damage. In the Religio-Philosophical Journal, December 25, 1880, copied from the Owatonna, Minnesota, review, there is a story maybe of a psychic bomb that was tossed through the wall of a house, in Owatonna, penetrating the wall, without leaving a sign of its passage through the material. It was in a house occupied by a family named Demant. There had been petty persecutions by an uncatchable, such as persistent ringing of the doorbell. One evening, members of this family were in one of the rooms, when something exploded. Mrs. Demant was knocked insensible. Fragments of a cylindrical glass object were found. But no window had been open, and there had been no other way by which, by known means, this object could have entered this house. I note something of agreement between notions that are now developing, notions that will be called various names, one of which is not practical, and experiments by inventors that are attempts to be very practical. It is said that by means of rays inventors have been able to set off distant explosives. If by other means, or by subtler rays, explosions at a distance can be made to occur, whatever the practical ones are trying to do may be far more effectively accomplished. If the data of this chapter do mean that there have been explosions that were the products of means, or powers, that are at present mysterious. There are stories of brilliantly luminous things that are called globe lightning that have appeared in houses, and have moved about, before exploding, as if guided by intelligence of their own, or as if directed by a distant control. These stories are easily findable in books treating of lightning and the freaks of lightning. I pick out an account from a periodical. There seems to be no relation with lightning. In the English Mechanic, 90-140, Colonel G.T. Pluckett tells of an experience, in July, 1909, in his home, in Wimbledon, London. He and his wife were sitting in one of their rooms, when his wife saw a luminous thing moving toward them. It went to a chair, upon the back of which it seemed to rest, for a moment. It exploded. Col. Pluckett did not see this thing, but he heard the explosion. As to the lightning explanation, he writes that it was a fine evening.